court is ready to hear argument in 050326 in re D. Wilson Construction Company, consolidated with 050327 American Standard and the Train Company versus Brownsville ISD.
May it please the court. Mr. John Griffith will present argument for the petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 10 minutes for rebuttal.
Good morning. My name is John Griffith. I represent D. Wilson Construction, a general contractor on some school buildings that were built in Brownsville, Texas. The real issue, I think, before the court is whether the supplementary conditions that were modified by the ISD created ambiguity in the arbitration clause in the general conditions of the contract between the parties. I also think that the other main issue is whether the trial court and the 13th Court of Appeals, for that matter, should have gone beyond just finding an ambiguity and attempted to determine the intent of the parties, and by stopping with the finding of ambiguity, basically just completed half their job. But before I get into those real issues, I think the first thing we need to establish is that the contract documents include the general conditions. Clearly, an $8 million project is not going to be built on a two-page contract. These two-page contracts cite the general conditions. The general conditions themselves cite that they are part of the construction documentation. The project manual cites that it's part of the project construction documents. And I think most importantly, the school district themselves, in their supplementary conditions, modified the general conditions. Clearly, they wanted it to be part of the contracts, part of the binding agreements between the parties, because they made modifications to it when they presented it to the general contractor. So for those reasons, it's, I think, fairly clear that the construction contract includes the general conditions. The general conditions have an arbitration clause in them. So then the question becomes, is that arbitration clause made ambiguous because of the supplementary conditions that were drafted and put into the general conditions? Now, the school district is claiming at this point that there's no arbitration clause at all in their latest pleadings in this case. They claim that the entire contract was found ambiguous by the trial court because the trial court wrote a letter that said that the contract's ambiguous, when clearly the only issue before the trial court was the arbitration clause ambiguous. There wasn't even an argument that the entire contract was ambiguous. And plus, the school district's kind of in a catch-22. If the entire contract's ambiguous and non-existent, what are they trying to enforce? How can they sue for breach of contract? And that's clearly not the case. So I think trying to say that the trial court, by saying the contract was ambiguous, implied that that more than the arbitration clause was ambiguous is not proper. Second, there's an attempt by BISD to look at the 13th Court of Appeals opinion, where the 13th Court of Appeals says that the contract does not include an arbitration clause, which it doesn't, because this part of the contract doesn't. However, it's included in the general conditions. Doesn't mean that there is no arbitration clause. So again, I think BISD really is back to where they were originally arguing, which is that the addition of the supplementary conditions 4.5.1.1 make 4.5.1 ambiguous. Now,
and how does it not? It seems to me,
first of all,
clearly make it ambiguous, huh?
And if what you're saying that the 4.5.1.1 addition to 4.5.1 makes it ambiguous, the reason it doesn't is because, first of all, you have to harmonize the provisions. 4.5.1.1 is basically a level 3 grievance hearing provision. If you have a fact question under the contract, you go first to the superintendent, then you take it to the board, and the board gets to make that decision. That does not supersede, and that the board's decision is final. That does not supersede the arbitration clause, which applies to disputes under, like, breach of contract and other claims and controversies.
Why not?
Because the school district cannot be the final arbiter. They can't issue a judgment that would bind.
Well, you wouldn't think. You wouldn't think, but it says fact question to be decided by the owner. Okay. I wasn't paid enough. Yes, you were. That's the end of that. I mean, that's what it sounds like.
The fact questions that they're referring to there are issues of fact as to what things are supposed to be built where. It doesn't go as far as claims and controversies, but let's assume, arguendo, that that's correct. that 4.5.1.1 does make 4.5.1 ambiguous. That's not where you stop. You have to go beyond that. Once you find ambiguity, you don't walk away from the contract. At that point, you have to figure out what the intent of the parties are. So you go to the next level.
What was the intent of the parties?
The intent of the parties was to arbitrate. The arbitration clause contained in 4.5.1 was included in the contract delivered by the agent of the school district, the architect, to the general contractor. They included it in there. They very clearly know how to modify, add, and delete to the general conditions because they did. They took out provisions. They put in provisions, and they modified provisions. They did not take out the arbitration clause, though. If they wanted the arbitration clause gone, they would have taken it out. They know how. They took it out of the architect's contract. They actually left it in a subsequent vendor's contract. So they are very aware of that provision, and they know how to modify it.
Someone comes in and says, we put this in like we were supposed to, and you owe us this much. And you don't agree with it. The owner doesn't agree with it. Then how do you decide, are we going to arbitrate that, or are we going to go with this owner calls it provision?
I would think that if it's going to be sufficient to where you're going to be suing for breach, and it's not just a, do I install brass fittings versus aluminum fittings? Do I do a certain thing under the project a certain way? But this is a dispute after the fact where they're coming back asking for money. It's a claim or controversy that's arisen. It's not just a fact question that's being resolved during the building process. But again, even if there is an ambiguity there, the arbitration clause is still in the contract. And there's a presumption for arbitrability. I mean, that's one thing that's clear in all the cases. The ambiguity should be construed against the drafter, the district. And the district knew how to take out the arbitration clause. They knew how to modify it. They knew how to make changes to it. Finally, and this is something I discovered as we were coming to argue, there was an affidavit by Mr. Bill Wilson that was introduced before the trial court, and I determined that I don't think it actually made it to the record for this court, but it was introduced in front of the trial court, and we're going to ask to be able to supplement that record since it was in front of the trial court. That very clearly, it's a clear and concise statement that the intent of the parties was to arbitrate. The intent of Mr. Wilson was to arbitrate.
What you're arguing right now is not in the record, you're saying?
It's in the record at the trial court stage, but it actually did not come up to this level for some reason. It didn't make it in, and I don't know why it was, but it was before the trial court. It was considered at that level, and I think it would be appropriate for the justices to consider it here since it was in front of the trial
court. So if the contract said in Clause 7 we're going to arbitrate everything, and Clause 12 we're not going to arbitrate, we're going to file a lawsuit in court for any disputes, your theory is we decide that because we favor arbitration?
My theory is that you've got an ambiguity. Now you've got to go one step farther. You've got to determine the intent of the parties. Did we mean to leave 7 in, or did we really mean to leave 12 in?
But how can you do that if the preamble to the supplementary conditions sort of says we give effect to these? I mean, it seems to say this modifies, changes, deletes, or adds to. This you got to look to this piece first.
Correct. And again, it modifies, adds, or deletes.
So if you had an arbitration agreement and something that's inconsistent with it, why doesn't it delete the arbitration provision by its
own
terms?
If you look at the actual language, it says, and I don't know if I have it in front of me, but it says that to the extent not altered by the contract, it starts out, it actually does a provision in the language.
Well,
it
generally says the following supplements modify, change, delete from, or add to, and okay. Then it goes down to except as otherwise provided in this contract.
Okay, and I guess I would defer to the except as otherwise provided in this contract because that's the language in 4.5.1.1 that says, that talks about disputes. In other words, the specific provision we're trying to harmonize says except as otherwise is listed in the contract. It says except as otherwise provided, and in this case, otherwise provided is arbitration. But to go back to the question, you have that presumption. You also have the ambiguity construed against the drafter. But mainly, you just don't stop with a finding of ambiguity. That, I think, is my fundamental issue here is the trial court needed to go beyond that and make a determination of what was the intent of the parties. And they stopped. They said ambiguity, period, end of sentence. And that's not where you stop. You have to go beyond that. And I think that's fundamentally the problem that needs to be done. I think
this is important. Tell me what that trial looks like on intent. That's always sort of fascinated me. It's controlled by the documents. And what's that going to look like?
I guess I'm going to need to ask for a little additional time.
You can answer that question.
Okay. The trial would be, well, first you go look at the documents itself. So you have an argument to the court about all the provisions within the contract. And then once you go beyond that, you can actually get into parole evidence and you can actually have witnesses, live witnesses. In fact, that's allowed.
I understand, but I mean, it's hard for me to imagine, you know, somebody's going to say, well, we intended to arbitrate. Somebody's going to say, no, we didn't intend to arbitrate. I can't see how that would work. Why wouldn't it be a better construct to follow our line of cases that say in order to compel arbitration, you have to show a clear agreement to arbitrate? Here there's no clear agreement to arbitrate because it's ambiguous, and therefore the trial court did not abuse its discretion.
Well, and see, I would defer that the line of cases don't say you have to have a clear agreement to arbitrate. I think what you have to have is there's a presumption that you're going to arbitrate. If there's an arbitration clause in there, that you do everything you can to enforce that arbitration clause as opposed to finding every way to get out from under it. I think that's the way the presumption works.
Any further questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondents and real parties.
May it please the court, Mr. Baltazar Salazar will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court, opposing counsel, on behalf of the Brownsville Independent School District, the Board of Trustees, and the General Counsel for the Brownsville Independent School District, and the children of the Brownsville Independent School District, we'd like to thank you for the opportunity to argue before you today. I think the court just hit a very good nerve right there. The policy that appellants are asking for is, let's arbitrate at any cost. That's not the law in the state of Texas. The state of Texas says there must be first an agreement to arbitrate. And that agreement must have an arbitration clause, must have some arbitration language in it. If there is no contract to arbitrate, you can't force it. I don't care if there's federal law that favors arbitration or state law, and we all know that there's a trend that way, but you can't force a party, such as a district, to arbitrate if there is no arbitration agreement. And if the court looks at every single case that appellants have looked at, have cited in their brief, the First Merit Bank, the Mena case, the Mouton case, every single case, they all talk about in the arbitration agreement, and a lot of these are employment agreements, it says on page one, which both parties signs, not an addendum, not by reference.
Well, but we've passed all that. In advanced PCS, we said specifically, you don't have to sign it because neither federal nor state says you have to sign the arbitration agreement. It says it has to be in writing and agreed to. And so the fact that it's in this one and you signed that one, we've already crossed that bridge. If the deal is the one you signed says this is all the parties' agreements, and over here in document 127, there's an arbitration agreement, just like there's general specifications over there. Well, you don't have to sign every general specification. The deal is arbitration agreements are neither more nor less enforceable than other provisions, and unless we're going to say both parties have to sign every page of the architect's plan, why is this any less enforceable?
The reason it's not less enforceable is because every case law that has looked at this issue says the contract that was signed talks about the document that signed reference an AIA document. In this case, there is no reference. And opposing counsel, in their briefs that they tried at the trial court level, they tried at the Court of Appeals, have said, well, there is a reference to an AIA document, A201. Well, what they haven't told the court is that that's not in the contract. The signatories did not sign that. It's not even in the general provisions. The general provisions actually refer to a third document, which is the AIA arbitration document.
But you're seeking to enforce all that, aren't you? All the provisions in the general provisions and all these supplemental AIA provisions, you want that enforced, don't you?
No.
You don't want any of that.
We do not.
The two pages?
I'm sorry?
You just want to enforce the two pages that were held up?
We want to enforce those two pages and any project manual pages that are in there. And in the project manual, it talks about, again, what we've been talking about earlier, the supplementary conditions. And again, I think the court went through and looked at the supplementary conditions, looked at the project manual, and I don't know what the court was thinking, but the court decided that that contract was ambiguous. The court didn't say the arbitration clause is ambiguous. It said the contract is ambiguous. So the supplementary conditions, our position has been ruled, because if there's any problems, the school district wants to be able to say, if we have a problem as to payment, the ultimate fact finder is going to be the school board, and it has it in the supplementary condition. It says we will control how much gets paid, when it gets paid.
And you think everybody on this project agreed that if after the school buildings were built, the school district decided they wanted it for free and said, no, we're not paying anybody anything, that'd be the end of that?
That can't be right.
I understand
that can't be right, but there's a lot of case, I think, before this court there that it says
a deal's a deal. You said we could stiff you at the end, and so we can.
It's called governmental immunity. And I understand.
If that's what you're standing on, we can argue about
no.
that. But I mean, you're standing on everybody intended that disputes be settled by the school board, meaning the school board could do anything they want. Really? That's your intent. Everybody understood that.
That is what is in the contract. That is what was reference to.
Why didn't that mean, as opposing counsel says, if there was a dispute while you're building the thing, do we have to add this or not add this? The school board settles that.
Well, because that's not what the contract says. The contract says any disputes. It doesn't say during the building. It doesn't say after the building. It says any disputes. It's not time barred.
Well, then what does it mean when it says except as otherwise provided in this contract?
What could that
possibly mean?
I'm not sure, but I believe that's where the court may have looked at the ambiguity. That may be, really, the trial court didn't go into the supplementary conditions. The supplementary conditions were first mentioned because they were part of the documents at the appellate court level. And the appellate court level said, clearly, if the court was looking at ambiguity, here's something that can show ambiguity. Here is some ambiguity.
And who's going to settle that? Jury? Or the judge?
The judge. I believe that is a matter of
when. When? I mean, we need to decide at the start whether we're going to arbitrate it or not. All that this judge has decided is it's ambiguous. What is he or she waiting for?
I don't know. I can't get in the court's mind, but it would have been nicer if the court would have had an order that says this contract is ambiguous and as per supplementary condition makes it further ambiguous as to the arbitration clause. That would have been nice. It would have been a good fact-finding, but it wasn't there, and I've only got with what the court gave me. Our position is that...
But when one party says we've got an arbitration agreement, the other says, no, there's not. Trial judge, you agree with me, has to decide that. So don't we have to reverse this case and make the trial judge decide that?
No, because before you ask the question, was there an arbitration agreement? You've got to say, was there a contract that included the arbitration agreement? That's what you've got to look at first. You don't look at, let's go look at the arbitration agreement first, or that part of it, because Texas favors arbitration. That's not the case law. The law is, let's look at the contract first. Is there an unambiguous contract first? Then we look at the arbitration clause. And if the arbitration clause is ambiguous, we wouldn't be here today.
Well, doesn't the trial judge have to determine whether the contract is ambiguous or not?
Yes.
And he said it was ambiguous.
He said it was ambiguous.
By the same token, why wouldn't we send it back for that decision to be made?
To find out whether the arbitration clause is ambiguous?
The contract. He said the contract was ambiguous. We don't know yet whether it's enforceable or not.
Well, that's what the finding was by the trial court, that the contract was ambiguous. He didn't go into the second part, whether the arbitration clause was ambiguous. And I want to redirect the court back to that issue. Is the issue here is really the trial court found that the contract was ambiguous. Does the court now force the district to go to arbitration because a contract was ambiguous? Or does this court ask the trial court to go back and look into the arbitration clause, if in fact there was? Our position has been from day one that the intent was not to arbitrate. And opposing counsel has stated that they'd like to supplement their intent. We would like to do it, too, because we have the attorneys that were representing the school district, which filed an affidavit at the trial court level that said, We specifically took out the arbitration language with the architects, and okay, placed in there arbitration.
So the ISD's position is the contract is not ambiguous, and that the arbitration provision has been deleted.
That's correct.
Why didn't you just say that in the contract?
The reason it wasn't said, there's two separate contracts. First of all, there's a D. Wilson contract and a Stotler contract. Those are two separate contracts that we're talking about, and they are different. And they don't, none of them state that the arbitration clause is referenced there. None of them state, all the case law that I have looked at all say, if in fact arbitration comes in, they state in there, by reference, we're going to put in arbitration. They have some arbitration language if, in fact, it is going to come into the original contract.
What about the other, as otherwise provided? That's pretty standard language in these type of contracts, and that generally refers to arbitration agreements.
Generally, it does, but this one, it doesn't. This one, it doesn't. If, in fact, Justice, the issue here today was whether 4.1, the arbitration, the standard form general arbitration clause, if that was ambiguous, I wouldn't be here. I wouldn't be before this court. We would have arbitrated this case just like we have three other defendants or four other defendants in the same case. The district knows when they arbitrate cases. And in that, we have other contracts where we had arbitration clauses, we send them to an arbitrator. In this case, the arbitration clause is not referenced. If there's no language in the contract, the supplementary conditions are rather vague. They're rather ambiguous. You could say, yes, the school board decides. You could say, maybe it's only during the construction. Maybe it's after construction. It is ambiguous. And I'm talking about the supplementary conditions. The other issue that I'd like to address to the court is the issue of waiver. I'd like to remind the court that the Brown School District is a defendant in this case. Most cases where anybody comes before this court to say we'd like to invoke arbitration is because they are the defendant. The Brownsville School District was sued in this case. American Standard Train versus BISD. One case that I've been able to find is the Vero versus Cates, and that case says that if you act inconsistent with your right to arbitrate, if you file suit, if you run to the courthouse, that you have waived it as a matter of law and you've given the defendant in this case the choice. There's only one case, and the reason there's only one case is because normally it goes the other way around. The defendant is asking for arbitration. I'd like to remind the court that we are the defendants in this case. The defendants have acted inconsistent with their right to arbitrate. That not only in this case.
If they sent you a letter saying let's go to arbitration, what would you have said?
We'd say let's look at the contract.
You would have said no, just like you're saying now.
No.
So they had to file a lawsuit to get somebody to order you to go to arbitration.
Well, that's not true because part of the record which I've included and part of the record from the trial court. This is the second lawsuit involving these same defendants. The first lawsuit was styled was also in Cameron County. It was styled the Castillo versus, I forgot, I believe it's Castillo versus D. Wilson, or it's Castillo versus Carol DeSan Rang. I've noted it in my case. That was a case that was filed in 2001. Some students and faculty members filed suit against all the general contractors in this case. In that case, this was 2 years before we were sued one time before. These same defendants, D. Wilson, Stotler, every single one in here, in that case, they were sued by students and faculty members. In that case, they filed the cross-claim. A cross-claim is a lawsuit. And I have taken excerpts from that case. That was 2 years before that. They didn't come in and say, we want arbitration in that case. They said, we want a judgment. We want a jury. They came for judicial relief. They came to the courts to ask for relief.
Did it involve the same contract?
It involved the same contract, the same set of facts. The school district was sued there. Not only was the school district sued in there, We had to spend close to $175,000, and there's an affidavit at the trial court trying to defend that suit.
Certainly parties can take inconsistent positions if it benefits your clients, right?
That is correct. However, if they have an arbitration, if they have an arbitration clause, they should have invoked it on that suit. They never did. They invoked, they were asking for a judgment, they were asking for a jury. And then after some of these defendants, specifically American Standard Crane, the district was taken out of that lawsuit, it was severed, and then was, because of the immunity which we have, we were severed, and then American Standard Crane goes out with some other defendants, and they appeal it to the 13th Court. So not only did they file suit, then they go to another court of appeals. Eventually that case was dismissed. But clearly, that is acting inconsistent with the right to arbitrate. This was before we filed suit.
Why didn't the school board resolve that case?
The school board was sued. We could not.
Could take it up to the board members and decide those factors.
That could have, that was an option. But that was, we were sued. We had to answer suit. We had to defend the suit.
So you waived your right for the school board to decide everything finally, too.
In that case, we did. You're. So that is the issue of waiver, and I think that's a really important issue, because if in this case a plaintiff acts inconsistent with their right to arbitrate, if they file suit against you, they're not acting consistent with their right to arbitrate. I believe that is a very, very important issue that was not addressed really, and the reason I don't think it's addressed because you'd never have a plaintiff say, oh, we're suing you. Oh, by the way, after we sued you, we want to arbitrate. That, the case law is clear that choice is given to the school district as a defendant. The other issue that I believe is important that I've seen the court go into, and they've raised it, is equitable estoppel. This court, I know, has had several cases before it in the recent year about equitable estoppel. And I went back and I read the cases, not only this case, but also the Fifth Circuit case, the Grissom case, to find out exactly what it meant. Because equitable estoppel is one of those bad headaches that I get from law school. I still don't remember what it is. And I went back and looked at the definition. I still couldn't figure it out. So I went back and I read the Grissom case. And the Fifth Circuit case says, it's called Grigsby. That Fifth Circuit case, which this court has used as a cornerstone, says there's two instances when the court can institute equitable estoppel. One of them is when the person suing, in this case a district, relies on the contract, which is true. Breach of contract, you can't rely on it more than that with its subcontractors. And here we have contractors and subcontractors. The second instance is when the cause of action is so intertwined between the contractors and subcontractors that you're almost forced to go there. But before you get in that Grissom case, the interesting part about it is that element number one is that the signatories must have a written agreement containing an arbitration clause. That is the key. If you don't have that written arbitration clause, and you don't have that written agreement, then equitable estoppel does not apply. And again, I go back to square one. Is there an arbitration clause in this contract? And the answer is no. The district has taken that position from day one and continues to take it. The district's position is that we should not be forced into arbitration if our contract didn't say arbitration. All of the cases that we've looked at are arbitration clause. They're all cases where on page one it's signed. They're arbitration, the times that the courts have referenced arbitration, they reference it in saying, look at the arbitration policy manual. That's on the document that's signed by the signatories. And the reason I say that is because I suspect that that's going to be an issue, the reference part. We do not believe that arbitration was referenced in the original contract with either Stotler or D. Wilson. In Stotler's case, the project manual is not even mentioned. In D. Wilson's case, no, I'm sorry. It's in D. Wilson's case that the project manual is not mentioned. And then in Stotler's case, It's mentioned, but they're the ones that filed the cross-claim against us in the suit 2 years prior. So either way, we feel that they have either waived their right to arbitrate or their contract never references the arbitration clause. And the one case that they rely on is a Teal case. And that Teal case says by reference, the contract says by reference, we're bringing in AIA document 201. This case is not like that. It's very fact-specific.
So, if we find the contract is ambiguous, if we disagree with you, do we resolve that ambiguity here? Do we send it back to the trial court, have them take a crack at it, make that determination?
If you find that the contract is ambiguous, you let the trial court keep its decision. The standard that's used is abuse of discretion. There's plenty in the record for the court to have decided it, that it is ambiguous, first of all. And then all the cases that have been cited by opposing counsel are the ones that say, well, if it's ambiguous, then it's in that it's improper for summary judgment. This is not a summary judgment case. If the trial court felt that it was ambiguous, the trial court is the trier of fact. They're the ones that saw the contract. They heard arguments. It was about a half-day hearing that we had there for this arbitration clause. If the trial court found that it was ambiguous, then we'd ask that this court not only follow the trial court's findings, but also the Court of Appeals findings.
Any further questions?
Just one quick one. So yes. You argued that ambiguity equates to no enforceable agreement to arbitrate, period. You can't compel arbitration if they're in the face of ambiguity.
Correct.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Mr. John Griffith and Mr. Mark Beeman will present the rebuttal for the petitioners.
Mr. Griffith, what do you say about that?
I think very clearly that if there's an ambiguity, it's the duty of the court to resolve that ambiguity. I mean, you don't create a contract and just make it unenforceable because there's an ambiguity. The case law is clear. What you do is you determine the intent of the parties. You try to resolve the ambiguity. You try to harmonize it either within the contract itself, and then if you have to go beyond that to parole evidence, you do that next.
But I think does trial court conduct proceedings and handle that initially, or does this court take first crack?
Now that we're here, I'd like for this court to render this decision because I think it's very clear from the contract itself. Again, the arbitration clause was not taken out despite what counsel said. The arbitration clause was very specifically left in, and the district knew what they were doing because they knew how to add, delete, and modify those conditions, and they chose only to add an additional 4.5.1.1. They didn't touch any of the other provisions that allowed arbitration, even though in other situations they deleted those provisions or deleted provisions that addressed other issues.
Please address Mr. Salazar's waiver argument.
And actually, I was going to allow Mr. Beeman to discuss that more directly. There is no waiver argument with regard to D. Wilson. D. Wilson filed no cross claims. D. Wilson took no actions inconsistent with enforcing the right to arbitrate. That was asked to other parties. So if it would be, please, the court, I could just wait on that one issue. I do want to address the non-signatory. I think that fundamentally the only position that was taken by counsel for BISD was if there's no arbitration clause, then the non-signatories can't latch on to it. Well, okay, that of course. If there's no arbitration clause, there's no arbitration clause. If, however, there is an arbitration clause, which is pretty clear from the contracts that there is an arbitration clause in there, albeit it may be ambiguous, then the non-signatories, because they are being sued pursuant to that contract, that's how the work was done by the subs and the other non-signatories, and because they're all being sued joint and severally for this entire project, they would fall within the equitable estoppel guidelines, and they would be tagged along with the general contractor under the arbitration provision. The other issue I think that was kind of important here, and it hasn't really come up yet, is the problem that we have with the TAA versus the FAA. I think because right now we're always trying to enforce the FAA because basically anything touches interstate commerce. We end up with a situation where you've got trial courts that, I mean, in this case, we're just lucky that he wrote the letter that says, I found ambiguity, because the order that was submitted that he signed just said, deny arbitration. The 13th Court of Appeals routinely denies mandamus without giving any reasons at all. They just say, mandamus denied. And so in this situation, we actually have a little bit of an idea what the court was doing, but if we were under the TAA, where we had an interlocutory appeal, where there had to be findings of fact, and we actually had an appellate procedure that covered that, we'd be having a lot more, we have a lot more information to be discussing before the justices. And I don't know how you resolve that other than perhaps some sort of request to the appellate courts and the trial court that they do a finding of fact, that they do present something other than just an order denying arbitration. So at least you have something more similar to the TAA if we're going to be taking all these cases up under the FAA, because basically the federal law preempts everything. And that, I guess, is a little bit of an aside, but I think that's one of the issues that may be something that the court would want to address with this opinion. I'm going to go ahead and defer to Mr. Beeman on the waiver issue.
If it pleases the court, I know this procedure is a little unusual, but these issues were separate and distinct between the parties on the petitioner's side. The first thing I'd like to address are the claims concerning waiver in this case. The respondent's attorney has indicated to the court that this case was brought by my client, Train, and that is correct. But the nature of the original petition in this case was only a suit for temporary injunction to preserve evidence. There was no claim brought by Train in this case seeking judicial resolution of the disputes between BISD and Train. It was only to preserve evidence at that time because there was a remediation project that was ongoing at the school or about to begin at the school, and the parties wanted a chance to go in and document evidence. So that's all that was there, and I don't think that is, by asking to preserve evidence, is certainly not taking a position which is inconsistent with arbitration. In fact, one could argue it's entirely consistent with arbitration to go in to preserve evidence, because you need evidence at arbitrations as well as at trial. The second action that respondent has brought up in his briefing and has brought up today is the fact that Train was involved in the Castillo matter. This is the personal injury case that was filed, I believe, in the 197th District Court. In that case, the students of the schools has sued Train along with a number of other defendants, including the school district. So this was not a case in which Train was lined up and bringing the school district into the case. This is a case where they were both co-defendants. And simply put, that case was a case involving personal injury. It was not a case that dealt with the property damage claims, which are the subject of the arbitration provisions, which are an issue in this case. So it would be our contention that because that case involved personal injury claims of students against two co-defendants, it would not be proper for arbitration. And that was our position then, and that is our position now.
It's your position that in that particular fact pattern, arbitration wasn't appropriate because it was personal injury, or arbitration is not appropriate any time involving personal injury?
Well, it was personal injury by the students. It was personal injury claims by the students, and they had no stake in these contracts whatsoever. So at that point, they were seeking judicial relief. They were seeking recovery for personal injury damages. And there's no way, at least that I can conceive, that they could be brought under the terms of the arbitration provision between co-defendants. They had their own independent claims for personal injury, which they were entitled to pursue. In connection with what happened in that case, in terms of the pleadings and how the parties lined up, there were cross actions in that case. And Train and the respondent has mentioned Stoppler filed cross actions in that case only for contribution and comparative responsibility assessment. So these cross actions were not filed by Train against the respondent seeking affirmative relief. It was only to seek findings of comparative responsibility, a defensive type finding, and not one that's seeking judicial resolution of the claims which are subject to the arbitration agreement today. So those are our points.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel. The cause is submitted, and the court will take another brief recess.